I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is the president of the Baltimore City Council, Nick Mosby. Mosby has promised to professionalize the operations of the council and the council president's office, an aspiration that mirrors those of Mayor Brandon Scott and Comptroller Bill Henry, who have made similar promises. We'll ask the council president how he intends to realize that goal. And we'll talk about the legislative agenda for the council, which has included bills that will change how landlords and tenants interact. Renters will have options other than posting a full security deposit when they rent an apartment, including purchasing instruments called surety bonds. Housing advocates say it's a bad deal for renters. Plus, what impact is an investigation into his personal finances having on the council president's work on behalf of the city? Nick Mosby joins me after the news. Thanks, Matt, and good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. We make it a point here on our show to bring you frequent conversations with the political leadership of the city of Baltimore, as well as leaders from around the state. We have regular check-ins with Mayor Brandon Scott, Comptroller Bill Henry, members of the City Council, and the President of the City Council, Nick Mosby, who is my guest for the hour today. The council's most recent legislative initiative aspires to change the power dynamic between tenants and landlords and address housing security in our city. Housing advocates have concerns about a bill that is currently on Mayor Brandon Scott's desk that will create alternatives to security deposits. And looking ahead, the council is exploring ways to strengthen city-based businesses as many of them struggle to cope with the financial impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. To join our conversation with Council President Mosby, we'll take calls a little bit later, but you could throw us an email or a tweet if you'd like for the moment. Midday at WIPR.org is our email address, and our Twitter handle is at Midday WIPR. Council President Mosby joins us from City Hall on Zoom. Mr. President, welcome back, sir. Good to talk to you.
No, thanks for having me on today, Tom.
So I want to begin with an issue that I hope doesn't dominate our entire conversation today, and that is the fact that there is evidently a federal investigation into your personal finances. Your lawyer, Mr. Bolden, sent a letter to the Justice Department in which he characterized it as a criminal tax investigation. Can you shed any light into why you think the U.S. attorney here in Maryland is looking into your personal finances, that of you and your wife, state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby?
I cannot. I know that, you know, when you're an agent for change, you know, people who like status quo to kind of remain the same, they're incentivized to try to stop you. And, you know, the reality is, you know, for the past 6 or 7 years since my wife boldly tried to prosecute officers for the death of Freddie Carlos Gray, you know, we've been through a lot, particularly behind the scenes. I mean, you know, she's been taken to the Supreme Court. We've had decisions on the Fourth Circuit Court, sued personally, and everything else in between. So, you know, just like all the past investigations, you know, we're going to cooperate in this. You know, I know one thing: the citizens of Baltimore know exactly who we are. And, you know, we can't allow it to distract away from the work like we have not for the past 6 or 7 years. And we will continue to push forward. You know, there was a lot of misinformation that could maybe construed as ill-intended that was put out about my wife and travel and pocketing money. And, you know, Marilyn, because of who she is and what she stands on from an integrity perspective, reached out to the OIG of the city. She's also reached out to the state ethics. It's been determined from both of those investigations that she did absolutely nothing wrong. And, you know, we're going to just participate in this current investigation. And, you know, we're going to continue to move forward. We can't allow it to distract away from the important work that we are so focused on.
There was a meeting a week or two ago with Isabel Cumming, the office of the IG office here in Baltimore, with some members of the NAACP, some local ministers, some attorneys. because there was great dissatisfaction with that investigation, which, as you say, was requested by your wife, State's Attorney Mosby. Can you tell us anything about the result of that meeting? Is anything going to change about the report, or anything going to change one way or the other?
No, I was not privy to whatever was discussed or the outcomes. Just like you, you know, I've read stuff through the media. You know, I know in the past the OIG said that if the city solicitor said her report had issues or had some concerns with her findings, that she would change her report. She has not, you know, changed her report. Again, since then, the state ethics have come out and said that my wife did absolutely nothing wrong. They actually said that she overreported, you know, overwhelmingly majority of elected officials in her position that, you know, go on these, you know, trips as it relates to bringing back, you know, best practices for the city, as it relates to traveling with other elected city officials, do not report, because they do not have to report these things, because these institutions or these prosecutorial or legal or law enforcement institutions, you know, do not have any, you know, business with the state and are not, you know, lobbyists or have any interests, you know, but she reported it. You know, she's quote unquote an over reporter. And that's what started some of those stories. That's where we are. You know, people are still reporting on it. But again, like she said from day one, when she called for those investigations, when she asked folks to look into all that was being reported on some publications over and over and over again, you know, she said that there would be no findings, and she was right. There was no findings from the OIG perspective. There's no findings from the state ethics perspective. And just like all the other past lawsuits, investigations, or what so, since, again, she charged the officers in the Freddie Gray case, you know, the expectation is going to be the same. I think we've been very clear that we've done nothing nefarious, illegal, and it's our job to participate in this. I'm a student of history. I know that she is not the first person to have to kind of go through things like this. Unfortunately, folks decided to make it public. It's supposed to necessarily not be a public thing, but we're going to participate fully, and we can't allow it to distract away from the work.
There was a lien placed on your home, which is, by the way, in the same neighborhood in which I live. We've been neighbors for quite a while.
No, Tom. There's no lien placed on my home right now.
All right. Wait, has you, that lien? Has it? Have has you seen? The, have has you, it been paid have you off?
Have you ever seen a lien, Tom?
Well, the IRS filing showed that have you owed taxes. That? I've not seen no, not okay, myself, so, no, sir.
All right, so you know, I'll definitely come back on when you produce the document that shows that there was a lien placed on my property. And
so you're saying it never happened?
I'm not saying that. I just said that a lot of stuff has been reported and constantly being reported. And
I'd be delighted to have you clear it up, because it's been reported that you owed taxes in 2014.
Yes, I owe taxes like millions upon millions of Americans. And, you know, I've worked it out with the IRS. I've had installments with the IRS. For some reason, my situation is unique, which is fine. But this idea that we had a lien on our property through that is just patently not accurate.
So there was never a lien, but you do owe taxes, and you've worked out a payment plan with the IRS.
There was never a lien on my property. No.
Okay. Do you understand the optics of this?
Totally.
We have an email from a listener here who says, you know, given this painful history of political corruption that we've had in Baltimore, and the listener says, and this Victoria says, I'm praying for you and your family, but do you, this is her words, do you understand why many Baltimoreans were upset to hear about the tax lien on your home? And now you're saying there was never a lien on the home. So we'll, you know, have that out there in the public record. But they also heard at the same time about State's Attorney Mosby purchasing two homes in Florida that are valued at over $1 million. There's just a disconnect there. If you've, you know, got, if you're owing money to the IRS, how do you qualify for a loan, or how do you even make the decision to spend money on expensive real estate, which is, of course, your right to do. You can buy any house you want anywhere. Is this the question
from the listener, or is this your question, Tom?
This is a question from the listener, and then here's my question. In addition to the listeners, should how public officials handle their personal finances matter to citizens? Should it matter?
I think totally. I mean, I think, you know, as it relates to someone's upkeep of their personal finances is a good indication of their ability to effectively and efficiently manage public money. I think that from a citizen perspective, we all kind of understand and know that at times things happen, at times things come up, but you know, you shouldn't be afraid to like communicate that or discuss that. That's why, you know, I haven't for a very long time. I originally communicated that there was a family situation that I needed to take care of, and I did at that particular time. You know, I've been very responsive to the IRS. I've always filed my taxes on time. I've always, worked with the IRS the entire time. I think millions upon millions of Americans on all different levels of socioeconomics kind of understand that. So I do. And, you know, that's why I'm on your show. That's why I don't hesitate to kind of talk about it. But things happen in life and you got to address it and you have to deal with it. And that's where we are. Like I said, unfortunately, the same publications that are talking about, my wife's ability to purchase a home, I'm not sure why that would be any different than anyone else's ability to purchase a home. She had the credit. She was able to secure the home. Why she should be precluded in doing that is it kind of strikes me. But I would just say it's the same publications that said that she pocketed $30,000 in travel, which couldn't have been further from the truth. It's the same publications that have spewed misinformation about us that couldn't be further from the truth. And, you know, we've constantly dealt with it and it is fine. It's just kind of part of the game. Again, when you're talking about folks who are literally going against the status quo, who are unafraid to speak for the disenfranchisement of individuals and communities in the city for far too long. When you're disruptive into a system that has benefited few and has oppressed many, this is kind of what happens. And again, as a student of history, I kind of understand and know that, and it's just part of the process.
Your wife, State's Attorney Mosby, offered tax returns to the Office of Inspector General for their report, in addition to many other documents.
She provided thousands upon thousands and thousands of documents for a 7-month investigation that turned out to be exactly what she told everyone on day one.
Mm-hmm. And during the last mayoral race, there were several candidates who released their tax returns as well to the public. Is that something you and your wife are considering? Do you file jointly?
That's nothing that we're considering on doing. I mean, I don't understand why we would do that at this point. Clearly, I think we have the trust of the federal government. You know, clearly the OIG has seen everything. I'm not sure why individual citizens at this point would need to see our tax returns any different than anyone else's. So no, that's not on the table at this point, Tom.
City Council President Nick Mosby is my guest. We will continue our conversation with City Council President about other issues ahead of the, or in front of, and in a couple of cases behind now, the Baltimore City Council. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. To join our conversation with Nick Mosby, our City Council President, our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWIPR. You can tweet me @TomHallWIPR. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday Indeed. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, more perspective and analysis of the 2021 session of the General Assembly. with former Republican Minority Leader Delegate Nick Kipke. New leadership was just elected on Tuesday, and Democrat Senate President Bill Ferguson. If you've just joined us today, I'm speaking with Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWIPR. My handle is @TomHallWIPR. So we do have a question, Mr. President, from a listener who calls himself or herself the new normal, characterizing as ridiculous the notion that anybody in the federal government would care about change at the local level, that that's not behind this investigation. Why do you think there is a relationship between the work you and your wife do and the fact that you are under investigation?
I have absolutely no idea. All I can say, Tom, is time will tell. Right now, I cannot be distracted. You know, we will constantly participate and cooperate like we've done for the past 6 years. But, you know, there's a lot of work to be done in the city of Baltimore, and that's what I'm focused on. So I can't, you would have to ask the federal government that. I am not the person to answer that question.
Let's talk about a referendum that's going to appear either on the 2022 ballot or for some reason as late as 2024. This just passed the General Assembly last week. It's a referendum to put the Baltimore City Police Department under local control. Since the 1860s, the control of the city police department is actually, it's a state agency, which surprises a lot of people when they hear that. What's going to be different about the Baltimore City Police Department being controlled locally than as a state agency? And what will the fiscal impact of getting full control, assuming that this referendum passes, and it's quite likely it will, what is the fiscal impact of that on the city?
Well, Tom, unfortunately, sometimes legislation carries names, but without reading the fine print, without understanding the policy, one can be misled. When we say that this bill is local control, it's actually not local control. What it does is it sets up an advisory board made up of elected officials, community members, even the Fraternal Order of Police representatives, to develop a solution or strategy and kind of work through all of what local control could mean for the citizens of Baltimore. Then there will have to be a referendum that will basically ask the state for local control. It will have to go back to the Maryland General Assembly after the report is provided to the governor and to the General Assembly. And this General Assembly will then have to change Article 2 to provide local control to the citizens of Baltimore. So as a person that enjoys policy, but absolutely loves the city of Baltimore, you know, I try to always communicate exactly what policy is doing much further than the name that was placed on a particular bill. So this is called local control. But through its passage and even through a passage of a referendum here in the city of Baltimore, local control will still not be here for the city of Baltimore. And you know, very early on, I had concerns about that because, you know, I'm not sure why delegates and senators in Calvert County and Dorchester County and Cecil County and Western Maryland and everywhere else kind of have a say on how the citizens of Baltimore and our local government kind of functions. Baltimore City is very unique in comparison to the rest of the jurisdictions where we do not have any control over the police department. It's actually in Annapolis, like you communicated, but this bill does not change that. There will have to be another bill that will probably not come into the session in 2023 or 2024 that could potentially give local control to the city of Baltimore.
Well, so it sounds like whatever is going to happen is going to take a while to happen. But can you speculate if some sort of referendum is passed, approved by the legislature and approved by the voters here in the city, what will the city be able to do that it currently can't do?
Well,
in an ideal world, even. I mean, what would you like to see the city be able to do that it currently can't do?
It's not... You know, right now from a legislative perspective, so I was one of the main proponents of body-worn camera. prior to Freddie Gray's death. I think we had a bill in 2014, maybe 13, when I served on the city council. And it was ruled that it was basically unconstitutional because it went against what Article 2 in the state basically says, that the Baltimore Police Department is a state agency. So in that instance, when we kind of set up this advisory committee, if the governor signs the bill, if we develop a referendum that the citizens of Baltimore pass, and if the governor enjoys and the state senators and state delegates enjoy the outcome of the advisory board, and they ultimately get a bill passed out of the General Assembly to change Article 2, in that example of body-worn cameras, the city council would be able to require body-worn cameras on officers. So that's like an example from an operational perspective associated with what local control could mean.
Let's switch to a bill that passed recently. It's now on Mayor Scott's desk, and this has to do with alternatives to security deposits for renters. Explain what the bill provides for and why you supported it.
So the bill, it's basically a renter's choice bill. So right now, we know that in the midst of a global pandemic, when there's a lot of emergency protections in place for renters, as well as homeowners, as we further get back to the normalization of our lives and some of those protections go away, there's going to be a tremendous amount of vulnerability in our communities associated with housing security. And what this bill does is provide renter's choice. So it basically allows a renter to choose whether to pay a security deposit, sometimes in upwards of $1,000, $1,200, $1,500, or $2,000, to pay that security deposit in a lump sum, or take out something that's pretty generally understood to be a surety bond, where that surety bond would cover the security deposit of the past. Now, this is a program that's been in place for decades. It's never been a requirement, but typically, the apartment owner around, say, like Johns Hopkins for grad students, or definitely in more affluent and wealthier communities, you know, have always offered this, but it's been always up to the landlord to kind of pick and choose who would be able to kind of have the requirement of a surety bond as opposed to paying that lump sum of $1,500 or $2,000 as it relates to a security deposit. So the other thing that this does is right now, particularly in communities of color and poor communities, many people know that you have to provide your security deposit, but the likelihood that you're going to get it back at the end of that lease is slim to none in a lot of cases. And there's really no protection other than you trying to go after and get a lawyer who's going to take a case to sue somebody to try to get $1,000 or $1,200 back. And that never happens either. What this bill does is provide added protection, where the onus is now placed on the landlord through the insurance commission to say, hey, Tom moved in this apartment. Here's the before pictures. Here's the after pictures. It's going to cost me $850 to correct what Tom messed up. And, you know, that's what I need from Tom to fix and have my repairs. And it will be the insurance commission, now a regulatory body of the state, that will have protections for the renter, but then also for Tom. So it provides a due process around when you transition out of an apartment.
All right. As you know, there are a number of housing advocates or people who are self-described housing advocates who oppose this bill. I believe we have one on the line, Peter from Baltimore. I assume you oppose this renter's choice bill. Can you tell us briefly why that is and pose a question to Council President Mosby?
Yeah. Hi. I do tenant advocacy in terms of tenant organizing and eviction prevention work. And I got to say, I think that calling this renter's choice is pretty disingenuous. That's a talking point that's taken right from this company Rhino's AstroTurf campaign. They have a fake, basically, community campaign that they're trying to push all these renter's choice bills all over the country. So the way that this actually works is that you pay Rhino a monthly fee that you're never going to get back. And then if the landlord comes after you, you're still on the hook for the money, but Rhino comes after you. You don't get to take your landlord to court. And in fact, you're forced into arbitration with the landlord and the insurance company. And you know how that's going to turn out. You know, there are a lot of things that we could have proposed to help tenants: rent control, cap and security deposits, allowing installments. But, you know, this was pushed through despite kind of the unanimous advice of housing advocates from the Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition, the Public Justice Center, Homeless Persons Representation Project, even the NLG chapter of Maryland. And I got to say, I wonder if, you know, given everything that's going on with the federal investigation, if, you know, there may be something going on between the rich hedge fund backers of this Rhino company and the city council president.
Well, there's certainly no evidence to that.
That was a pretty loaded question, Tom. But, you know, hey, this is the time and tell. First of all, I had no idea what this company Rhino was or who they were. We formulated this policy well before they even reached out. This idea that this isn't renter's choice, I don't know what I don't want to play semantics, but I don't know the definition of choice. But it provides a renter the ability to say whether you're going to pay $1,500 or $60 over the course of a year to this company. Again, as it relates to the protection, the idea that the landlord is now on the opposite side of an insurance company provides added protection to an individual. If I have a mother in West Baltimore that has a child and has an apartment and she pays her $1,200, at the end of the day, when she goes on to move on to a new apartment, she has no protection. It's just her versus the landlord's word and kind of going back and forth. The only last thing I'll say, which is really, really interesting, is prior to us introducing this legislation, we had several meetings with all of the advocates. When we announced this, the Public Justice Center stood with us to announce it. The amendments that they proposed, we accepted every single amendment during the initial hearing, and then all the way through the entire cycle of the bill, we only did not accept one amendment, and that was an amendment we just didn't have the legal authority to kind of push. So again, this idea that this was a one-sided thing, this idea that a bill that took over 3 months was just like pushed through, and this idea that we weren't working with folks in the community as it relates to rental protection groups, it's just not accurate. When you talk to mayors all across the country, they are very supportive of this. For some reason, the advocates, like I believe the caller name was Peter or Paul, have lurched on to this one particular company. They're not the only game in town for some reason. I have no relationship with them, never heard of them. You know, it's just interesting times. What I will say is I think that this is also an indication of, you know, this council moving in a different direction. In the past, the council has always been kind of this institution that the administration, you know, pushed legislation on. But we're creating a real legislative body that's going to have thought-provoking legislation that's going to kind of have these type of debates and discourse. And, you know, I'm excited about it. This is part of our first package as it relates to housing relief for the citizens of Baltimore. You know, I'm definitely interested in coming back in a year or 2 years or 3 years and reviewing it if some of the claims that have been put out there that we have not been able to identify around the country are true. But I'm excited about this bill. I think renters are excited about this bill. And hopefully some of the advocates who have in, you know, recent days come against it, we'll get back on the side that they were when they helped us introduce it.
City Council President Nick Mosby is my guest. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. And listeners, let me just comment that Peter, with all due respect, our last caller, if you have legitimate points to make about the downside of a bill like this, that is certainly welcome. We'd like to hear all perspectives. There are others who hold that view. But to simply insinuate that because a company has lobbied for this bill, that somehow they are, financial supporters of Mr. Mosby, or that Nick Mosby is involved in some sort of, you know, nefarious relationship with this private company with no evidence whatsoever, is simply not fair, not accurate, and not welcome at this table. Everyone is welcome at the table here at Midday to voice opinions that are premised in what we know to be truthful. And the whole point of having any conversation with Mr. Mosby or any other politician, any other city leader or leader of any on any level of the government is to find out what the truth is, to find out what the best solutions to problems are. So making these insinuations and it has nothing to do with Nick Mosby personally, but it making those kinds of insinuations, I think, is very much off base. So, Mr. Council President, there are folks, though, who say that companies like this company, which is called Rhino, they don't have a very positive track record in terms of transparency and accountability. The Better Business Bureau, according to them, rates them poorly. There are many, many complaints, citizen complaints from tenants to try to, you know, get them to act as advocates on their behalf. Did you look into that? Do you have confidence that the companies like Rhino that are issuing these surety bonds, in fact, are good actors?
Yeah, when I talk to the overwhelming majority of folks here in the state of Maryland that have used this product in Montgomery County or Howard County, they're very supportive. Many times when you talk to grad students that will say like transplant here from other places and go to Hopkins or go to University of Maryland College Park or even University of Maryland Baltimore, they're very excited about it. When I talk to my colleagues, other elected officials in other states that have passed this type of legislation in the past that we kind of model our legislation off of, they say overwhelmingly their constituents are supportive of it. So, you know, this idea that, say, in Atlanta or Cincinnati and all the other places that this has been currently enacted in, the idea that there's a large swell of folks who are totally against this and who have problems with it, it's just not, it hasn't been anything that we've been able to uncover. Nor that has been provided to us. The Sun did a very in-depth investigation about this, and they came out supportive of it. Again, based off of, unfortunately, Peter said that it's not renter's choice. I'm not sure what else is renter's choice other than saying you have to pay $1,500 in a lump sum at the beginning or $60 over the course of 12 months, you know, $5 a month to get the same exact apartment. This provides options for our renters. This provides desired locations for folks where they want to kind of move and migrate their families to. And again, in the midst of a global pandemic where we know that there's going to be a considerable amount of movement and displacement, you know, providing as much housing relief was our goal. And I think through the three bills that we have pushed forward that many of the advocates, again, stood with us on the day that we announced it, we're still excited about it.
We'll have more with City Council President Nick Mosby on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. 410-662-8780 is our number. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Midday on your public radio. Member supported 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It is Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby. He is part of a troika of leaders elected to citywide office who have promised to professionalize the mayor's office, the comptroller's office, and the city council. Mayor Brandon Scott has hired a city administrator, Christopher Shorter, to handle day-to-day operations. Comptroller Bill Henry has begun the process of transferring real estate records to an online database instead of storing them in hard copies. And City Council President Mosby has asserted that he too has taken steps to operate the council in ways that reflect best practices. Last December, Mosby's request to greatly expand the council's staff was turned down by the mayor, who cited budgetary constraints. The council president is with us until the top of the hour to join our conversation. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. So, Mr. Council President, per our conversation at the top of the show about whether or not there is a lien on your property because of taxes. You asserted, contrary to reporting in the past, that there was no lien. My colleague Emily Sullivan tweeted about that. She's a City Hall reporter for WIPR. And Justin Fenton, as you know, a reporter for the Baltimore Sun, tweeted a copy of the lien. So it does appear that there is, in fact, a lien, or there was at one time a lien on your property. Let me ask you to respond. Mr. Council President, can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah. I think, Tom, you stated in the question that there was a lien on my house and that you lived in the same neighborhood that I lived on. I think what they provided you was notice of a federal. Yeah, so this is not a lien on the property. This is that. So, you know, if you owe the government a dime or if you owe the government whatever, there could be a lien that's out there because that's an amount of money that you owe. So, you know, I've always stated that I owe taxes. I even talked about the installment. I just said that there was never a lien that was rendered on my property.
All right. So Justin Fenton of the Sun is saying that he has a copy of the lien
on my property. He has a copy of the notice of the tax lien.
The notice of the tax lien. What's the difference between the notice of the tax lien and the lien itself?
So again, if you owe the federal government any amount of money, they can always take out a lien on you. But there is no lien on my property. I think the question you stated was that there was a lien on the property in Reservoir Hill, and you said that you lived in the same neighborhood. And I said, Tom, there's never been a lien on my property.
Well, I can't confess to understanding what you're saying, Mr. Council President.
I'll say it again.
They're two separate things. First of all, I just wanted listeners to know, as I always I live in the same neighborhood,
correct.
which is neither here nor there.
You said that there was a lien on my house. Do you remember that? And I said no.
Is there a lien on some other property that you own?
No, there's no lien on any property. However, as I told you, that, you know, I did owe taxes like millions of Americans. We went through that whole segment. I talked to you about installment, told you that I've always been responsive to it. I told you where it came from. I think the point I corrected you on was that it's not a lien on my property. I don't have a property lien.
All right. Well, listeners can check out the tweet from Justin Fenton. And again, I'm not a legal expert, so I don't know the difference between what we've got here in this tweet and how you're explaining it, but I'll, you know, that's your position, and I want to make sure that we gave you a chance to state that position. Going back to some of the legislation that the City Council is going to take up, there is a bill that you've introduced. You introduced this early in March, called the Dante Barksdale Act. Dante Barksdale, our listeners will recall, a Safe Streets liaison who was murdered earlier this year. Tell us about that legislation and what you're intending to do in that regard.
So it's a bill that I had a relationship with Dante Barksdale. He was a young man who completely changed his life around 180 degrees and poured into the community and particularly young folks behind him. He was a Safe Street worker where he basically interrupted violence on the street. Unfortunately, he was succumbed to some violence. The Baltimore Police Department is still investigating that crime. But one of the last pieces of communication I had with him, he talked about trying to provide opportunities for young folks through employment. So what we're trying to do with this piece of legislation is develop a fund that city contractors, folks that get city contracts through the Board of Estimates, would be responsible for putting money into this fund, and that would go to CTE programming. You know, there's huge succession issues here in the city of Baltimore as it relates to our departments of DGS, DOT, or DPW. But then also we have to plan out what the jobs are of tomorrow and providing our young folks real opportunities. We know every single child is not necessarily going to be on a pathway to college, but they could be on the pathway of success through a career. So providing them through the Baltimore City Public School System and enriching the CTE program is where these funds will ultimately go.
And Where are those funds going to come from? Who's is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I said. What's the new city contract? So basically, you know, the city has, you know, millions upon millions of dollars of contracts. So it would be somewhat of like a apprenticeship program fund that the contractors would be required to pay into through city contracts.
How about efforts to strengthen local companies and small businesses? There is, you know, the contracting process. I know you want to revise and update, but if we're going to be dinging contractors for more money to fund the CTE education initiative, isn't that making it more difficult for these small businesses to do business with the city? It's going to be more expensive for them.
No, I mean, it's not going to be, I mean, this is not thousands upon thousands of dollars. However, this is a fund to help booster and augment existing programs. I think that when we look at our city contractors in a city that has a $3.6 billion, I think that we can agree all that we all need to do more, particularly as it relates to our young folks. And either we're going to invest now or pay later. And I think that we've seen that not only as it relates to our city government budget, but we've seen that through many different areas, that the idea we're putting less and spending less and providing less opportunities for our young folks. So when we talk about the systemic issues around crime and safety, when we talk about growing our city, we have to do it in a way that's providing real opportunities and increasing the trajectory of our young folks. So I think that this is an all hands on deck type of approach, not just from city government, that we need to do more. I've constantly talked about through our budget must be our priority to give more and provide more for our young folks. And we need companies that are doing business in the city, many of which are not city companies. Many are not even companies in the state. But, you know, they need to do more as well when we talk about these very lucrative city contracts.
When you talk about professionalizing city government, professionalizing the work of the city council, what do you mean? What kinds of things are you changing to further professionalize the operation?
We made a lot of changes. One, the structure of the council. So when I took over, say in Annapolis, we have 141 members of the House. We had 6 committees. When I took over the city council, we had 15 members and 13 committees. So when we talk about increasing diversity on really key items, when we talk about having that debate and discourse, and from a democratic perspective, we should no longer have, you know, committees that are made up of 3 members. I mean, literally 2 members can get a bill on the floor. So we increased the size of our committees. We streamlined some committees that were just single topic issues. We brought them into other relevant areas like connecting community development with transportation or connecting education with workforce development. So that was one just from a structural perspective. When we talk about the way that we approach the Board of Estimates meeting, you know, literally we've taken that meeting from a 15, 20 minute meeting to a 2-hour, 2.5-hour meeting because we're really digging into the details. I think it's kind of like my background as an electrical engineer that's managed multi-million dollar, very large projects in the past. I think it's my background that kind of forced me the opportunity to be able to do that. But that is literally the city business that happens every Wednesday at 9 o'clock and is really, really important. When we talk about this idea that Baltimore City is, if not the only major metropolitan area that does not have folks to do fiscal impacts associated with proposed or passed legislation, that does not have policy analysts that are going out trying to identify best practices, read white papers, and bring real data-driven solutions back to the citizens of Baltimore. You know, that's an area that I've constantly pressed on. I mean, we see that in our state house because it's important there. We see it in all state houses across the country. And like I said, you see it in major cities all across the country as well. Baltimore City residents, Baltimore City deserves that. So from a legislative perspective, we're definitely pushing towards that. And, you know, I think when we talk about this first relief package as it relates to housing relief, that's indicative of the type of professionalism and the type of approach that we want to take around legislation. And we're going to continue to do that.
All right. And Mr. Council President, you'll forgive me, but there are a number of people who still need clarification about this business regarding the tax lien. What I'm looking at is a notice of federal tax lien It says there are liabilities, meaning tax liabilities, that remain unpaid. This is dated March 3rd, 2020.
So, Tom, we can
and
talk
I want to give you one more chance.
Over and over again.
But it says, therefore, there is a lien on this property. That's what it says in this document. So I just, again, there are folks who are wondering.
I haven't seen that document. I don't have the document. Does it list the property, Tom? Is that what you're telling me? It lists my home address?
Yes, sir, it does.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that document.
All right. Well, we'll it's tweeted by Justin Fenton, so you can take a look at it.
I just opened it up right now.
Okay. But it does, it states there is a lien in favor of the United States on all property and rights properly, you know, assigned to this.
Yeah, I see it, Tom.
So, you know, any further comment then about it? And we'll move on to another
It would have been nice if he would have provided that in the past. I'm not sure how he was able to get it and where it came from, but this is the first time I'm seeing it.
So you've never seen this
records,
before.
If you go on public records, it's not there. If you go and request
they
it.
They didn't mail this to you. You didn't.
No,
you did not receive this from the federal government.
No, I haven't seen that.
You've never seen it.
Yeah. I have not seen that. That would make me a bold-faced liar in front of you. No, I have not seen that.
All right, because it appears that it's something that they would send to you at your address. Just got a couple of minutes left. Let's talk about the budget and that process and what role the city council will play in the city budget for next year.
So, I mean, you know the charter amendment that, you know, the city council will ultimately have some level of autonomy associated with redirecting funds come the 22 budget. This year, we're working with the administration. We have the preliminary budget. And, you know, we look forward to, you know, working with them and being partners in progress to try to identify what the priorities are of the city and moving the city forward. I think the interesting thing about the next 2 years is the federal money that's going to come down from COVID, a little over $600 million. The one thing that I've constantly talked about is, you know, I think that we should try to develop ways of utilizing the money to develop transformative types of results, you know, really trying to go after and tackle some systemic issues that have been plaguing, you know, our city for far too long and things that are going to grow our city and move our city in a new direction. We can take the standard approach of, you know, parsing out money in different buckets everywhere. Or we can identify what are the two or three things that we want to tackle for the next generation, kind of almost like a Baltimore City New Deal type of solution. And, you know, that's what I'm really interested in. I'm looking forward to working with the mayor on that and pushing forward there.
We're told that the city is in line for $670 million of federal subsidies under the American Rescue Plan. Any thoughts about how that money should be spent?
Tom, that's exactly what I just answered. That's what I brought up. I said the city is going to get this federal money over $600 million in two chunks, and we shouldn't look at to like parse it out. What we should do is develop a way of trying to develop transformative solutions and ideas that are going to be generational changes. So right, you know, well, that's what I was talking about.
Okay, I apologize. I was having a little
funny
stuff.
You might have to go back to the tape, Tom. And,
yeah, there's some funny stuff going on in my ears here.
The third time. I don't know if you got a lot of people in your ear and you're reading a lot. What's going on? But that's the second or third time that we're talking about stuff and you forgot.
I do have some stuff in my ear, but that's all the time we have, and I apologize for that. My guest has been Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby. And Mr. Council President, we look forward to the next time. Thank you so much for
this.
This
is always good. Thanks a million, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, analysis and perspective about the 2021 General Assembly session with leaders of both parties in Annapolis. Democratic Senate President Bill Ferguson joins me, along with the former Republican Minority Leader in the House, Delegate Nick Kipke. So stay tuned now for Here and Now. That's coming up after news from NPR at the top of the hour. And a reminder to check out the Daily Dose, WIPR's compendium of our coverage of the local scene that drops every weekday evening. I also hope you'll check out the Chesapeake Connect podcast, in which I host conversations with local leaders about opportunities for regional solutions to challenges facing jurisdictions throughout the Baltimore metro area. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us today on Midday. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Midday with Tom Hall on your public radio. This is member-supported 88.1 WIPR.